Paul Schrader and Martin Scorsese have a long history as collaborators. Schrader wrote the screenplays for the Scorsese films Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and The Last Temptation of Christ. His directing credits include the films Affliction, American Gigolo, and Hardcore. Schrader's latest movie, Autofocus, is now out on DVD. This is how Terry described the film.
Autofocus is about sexual obsession and how it can be fed by the adulation that comes with celebrity. It's based on the true story of a minor celebrity, Bob Crane. He starred in Hogan's Heroes, the 60s sitcom set in the unlikely place of a World War II prisoner of war camp run by the Germans. Here's a scene from the actual sitcom featuring the characters of Sergeant Schultz, Colonel Klink, and the American POW Hogan, played by Bob Crane.
Gentlemen, gentlemen, sorry to disturb your beauty sleep. This won't take very long. Count them, Schultz.
Yeah, we're coming on. Hey. It's all the excitement.
Ah, Colonel Hogan. Good evening.
Don't you Germans ever knock?
I wanted to keep it a surprise.
It's bad taste waking people up in the middle of the war.
Just a minute, Hogan. The count is not over yet.
All right, get on with it.
What's your rush? You're not going anywhere.
As a matter of fact, I have a date in town.
Oh, really? Who's the lucky girl?
It's not a girl, it's an Eskimo.
Good old Yankee sense of humor.
Right. We're going to laugh all the way to Berlin.
What viewers of Hogan's Heroes didn't know is that actor Bob Crane was obsessed with sex. He used his fame to attract women and would often record his adventures with them on early state-of-the-art home video. After Hogan's Heroes ended in 1971, Crane had trouble finding work. He toured the country doing dinner theater. In this scene from Autofocus, Crane is washed up and still trying to impress women with whatever celebrity remains from his Hogan's Heroes days. Sitting at a hotel bar with his eye on a woman, he asks the bartender to switch the TV to the channel showing a Hogan's Heroes rerun. Crane is played by Greg Kinnear.
I'm sorry to bother you. It's just that I was sitting over there and I noticed the TV and I... Well, is that you on the TV, is it?
Oh, my gosh. That is embarrassing. I didn't even know it was on. I'm Bob Crane.
I know. I thought so. Yeah. Bob Crane. Gosh, it's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Oh, Susan.
Susan, all right.
I loved your TV show.
Well, appreciate that. I'm just in town here to do a little bit of theater.
I just wanted to say hi.
Sure. Can I get you something? Another drink? An autograph? A nude swim?
Bob.
You know, I'm a real photo nut. And how long are you girls in town?
Bob Crane's secret life was uncovered after he was beaten to death in his hotel room in 1978. I spoke with Paul Schrader about directing his new film, Autofocus. How do you see the character of Bob Crane connecting with other characters you've made movies about, like Travis in Taxi Driver, or the character in American Gigolo, or the father in Hardcore?
Well, I mean, I think that, beginning with Travis, the first script I wrote, or going to Affliction, you have a person who is, again, acting at cross purposes. And so, Bob Crane is saying, I'm a one-woman man, I'm a family man, and all the while this tail is growing out his backside. Usually, when I make these kind of characters, at some point, at the end, they have a brief moment where they get it, because essentially they're kind of clueless and they're out of sync. And all of a sudden they get it for a moment. Wade Whitehouse in Affliction gets the fact that he has to kill his father. But Bob Crane never gets it. He's as clueless on the day he dies as he was on the day we meet him.
Yes, the Bob Crane character in your movie is delusional. He's clueless. He thinks he's kind of happily indulging in sex, not realizing the depth that he's thinking to. But he also narrates the movie. So what are some of the tricky issues you have to deal with when the main character is narrating their own story, but they're kind of totally delusional and clueless about what's really happening to their life?
Well, you've just touched on something that I really love doing, which is the unreliable narrator. Because narration works sort of like intravenous feeding. You're getting nourishment, but you don't taste it. So it seeps into your consciousness. And so, therefore, you assume that your narrator is reliable. Well, when he's unreliable, it creates a nice little frisson between what you're seeing and what you're hearing. And again, it goes back to Taxi Driver, you know, my first script, where you had an unreliable narrator. He was telling you how the world worked, and you were seeing that world, and it wasn't working the way he was telling you it worked. Again, the same here with Mr. Crane. So the narration does a number of things. It helps you expositionally because you're covering 15 years. It also allows you to hear how this man thinks. But it also creates an odd dislocation between what you're hearing and what you're seeing.
In your movie, the character of Bob Crane has a friend named John Carpenter, who's based on a real character in Crane's life. And he's a high-end video salesman and repairman who's in on all the new technology of the 60s. So you have, you know, he's selling these like emerging video tape recorders that you can use at home and video cameras, and this is kind of revolutionary for home recording equipment, and the celebrities, the rich people, are the first people who can afford to buy it. So Crane's really thrilled to get into this. Tell us a little bit about the John Carpenter character and his role in the story.
Carpenter worked for a company called Sonicom at that time, and they were issuing the first VTRs, which was videotape recorder, before they were VCRs. And he kind of freelanced, and he tried to place this equipment in the hands of celebrities, as they often do when they have a new product. And he had sold one to Richard Dawson, who was a gadget freak, and then Dawson was on the same show, Hogan's, as Bob Crane, and he met Bob Crane. Well, they became pals. And Bob's eldest son, you know, told me that he thought John Carpenter was his father's only friend. And they hunted chicks together, and they hunted chicks for a dozen years. And they videotaped and cataloged their exploits. And you know, they became a kind of symbiotic team. When Crane was murdered, it was the police theory that Carpenter killed him because Crane was trying to break off the relationship. They subsequently took John to trial, and he was acquitted. It was a good fit for them. It was motive, means, and opportunity. Unfortunately, they just didn't have the evidence. And the jury was out about 20 minutes, and he was acquitted.
Another interesting thing about Bob Crane is that here he is, a celebrity overindulging the sexual appetite, but he's a kind of small-time celebrity. He's kind of like a one-hit wonder. And, you know, at a certain point in his life, he has to go to, like, hotel bars to find women who will recognize him. So it's another really interesting angle of it, that it's not this big celebrity he has. It's kind of small time.
Well, he ended up on the dinner theater circuit, which you know, was quite lucrative, and it brought him into, you know, all the bedroom communities of America. And
their bedrooms.
Yeah. And he had, you know, a regular routine. You know, they would do the show, and then he would come out afterward and speak to the audience and sort of work them up and tell them where he was going to be. And he had it down.
And in terms of, like, small-time celebrity, John Carpenter, the video salesman, is always bragging about how he sold video equipment to Tommy Smothers, Dick Rowan, and Elvis. And I love hearing their names all mentioned in the same sentence, like Dick Rowan and Elvis on the same level.
Actually, you also sold it to Jay Silverheels, who played Tonto, and there's a whole kind of Lone Ranger and Tonto motif in the film because Carpenter was half Indian, and of course Bob Crane was the masked man.
Right. As you explained, because John Carpenter is this video whiz, he hooks up this videotaping system where he and Bob Crane can secretly tape their sexual adventures with the women they bring over. And then they can get aroused again by watching back the tapes. And they often watch the tapes together, and they masturbate while watching these tapes. You have a scene in which that happens that's a really interesting scene. And I'd like you to talk about shooting that scene, directing that scene, and what kind of tone you were aiming for in that scene. Because you have to strike the right tone.
Yeah, I like that scene. I think it's an absolute hoot. And while we were shooting it, I had to sort of bite my tongue to keep from laughing. You know, they're sitting there watching the videos and complaining about women, you know. And Crane says, "What is it about women, Carp? You know, they get you and they change their minds." And all the while, you know, they're jerking off and can't quite figure out why women don't understand them. And I just thought this was just delicious in the extreme. And I ended up the scene and fell back and did a kind of tableau, which I sort of like to think of as my Norman Rockwell. You know, the all-American scene, only in this case it's these two home porn pioneers complaining about women and watching their videos.
Instead of drinking beer and watching the football game and complaining about women. Right. So what was it like directing that scene? What did you tell Willem Dafoe and Greg Kinnear before shooting?
Well, as in everything in this particular film, you want to keep underplaying it always, because it's the accretion of underplaying that finally, you know, gets under your skin and feels really creepy. And so that you're always understating it. So I think Greg at one point wanted to separate the women talk and the masturbation. And I said, you know, if you do that, then you lose the underplaying. The truly sort of funny, odd thing about it is that, you know, both these activities can happen at the same time and they don't see the connection.
No, that's how clueless they really are. The look of the earlier scenes in the movie, in which Bob Crane is still a family man and he hosts a very popular morning radio show in Los Angeles and then starts on Hogan's Heroes, which becomes very successful. The look of those earlier scenes is much different than the look of the later scenes as he descends deeper and deeper into this sexual obsession. Can you talk a little bit about the difference in shooting the earlier scenes and the later scenes?
Well, we came up with an idea called the accretion of clutter, which is that his life just gets messier and messier. And it originally began as an idea for set design. And then we applied it right across the board, color scheme, film stock, camera style, hair, makeup, wardrobe, music, camera technique. And so that by the end of the film, you know, you become aware that you are watching a different movie than you were watching an hour ago. And therefore, there's a kind of incremental shift in all the elements of the film, trying to obscure the exact point where it shifts into another sensibility. You know, much like an addiction itself, you know, an addict can't really tell you the moment it all changed.
And what's different about the camera technique?
Well, it starts out very fluid, you know, dollies and locked off and dollies, and then it moves to Steadicam, and then it moves to a kind of handheld pretending to be steady, and then it moves to a handheld not pretending to be steady, and then it moves into hardcore shaky cam where you're going out of focus and everything.
And what about the visual clutter you're talking about, you know, the theory of clutter? How does the visual clutter change as the movie evolves?
Well, that first just came out of the idea of cords, of TV and electronic cords, and everybody who's had video in the house knows what a mess that technology makes of your house. And so just using that idea and taking it forward so that the neat, well-ordered house of 1965 becomes the video clutter of 1978.
Now, there's a scene early on in the movie where Bob Crane meets with a priest. And this is when he's still kind of holding to the fiction of his life. And the priest says, "It's not easy to resist temptation. You must remove yourself from the occasion of sin." I thought of two things when the priest says that. One is when he says, "It's not easy to resist temptation." I thought of your film, The Last Temptation of Christ, obviously. And then I also thought a little bit about your own life, since you grew up in a fundamentalist family, in a family where even dancing and going to see movies was forbidden. So I guess I'm wondering if when you broke away from that, where so much that we would consider ordinary and commonplace was forbidden, if it was ever easy to swing to the other extreme and overindulge in things that had been forbidden.
No, I don't think so for me, because I had a Calvinist background, and that ethic is pretty rigorous, and it's pretty hard to escape. This whole sense that you are put on this earth for a reason, there is a moral certainty. At the end of your life, you will be called into account. Even when you leave that world, and even when you break away from it, those elements still stay with you. You know, you really can't run far away enough to run away from that. So, you know, even though, you know, I became so-called liberated and lived in Los Angeles, my primary drive was the work and to do things that I felt would be worthy of my talents.
You said that Pauline Kael convinced you to become a film critic instead of a minister, which is what you mm-hmm. were originally studying to be. What did she say to you that convinced you?
No, I was in pre-sem, and I had met her through one of those serendipities of life that changes one's life. And I had come to New York for a summer to see movies because movies were forbidden and I wanted to know more about them. And after meeting her, she said, you know, you want to be a film critic and we are going to keep in touch. And we did. She became my mentor and eventually she got me into UCLA Film School and got me a job as a critic.
Your first produced screenplay was Taxi Driver, and in the book Schrader on Schrader, in which you're interviewed and also some of your early work is reprinted, you said that when you were writing Taxi Driver, you were very enamored of guns, you were very suicidal, you were drinking heavily, and you were obsessed with pornography in the way a lonely person is. Can you talk a little bit about that obsession with pornography and how, if at all, it figures into the new movie Autofocus?
Well, I was wandering, and at that time in Los Angeles, where I was living, you know, the Pussycat Theaters were open all night long, and so it was a kind of loner's paradise. And also, it really is such a strong visual world that it kind of is like a narcotic or alcoholic kind of, you know, blurs and blots out all the other pain in your life. So I think that was really more of the function than any overheated purience.
I want to just get back to that quote from the book Schrader on Schrader, where you said that, you know, when you're writing Taxi Driver, among other things, you were very enamored of guns and you were suicidal. You owned a gun then. Was the gun for possible suicide or for self-protection?
I think, again, you're talking about blotting out a certain level of emotional pain. And just the fantasy that you can end your life is a palliative and an anesthetic. So that kind of drifted around in the back of my consciousness for a number of years. And then when I got married, and then, I had a daughter, and I remember quite well, it was, you know, shortly after she was born, I was lying in bed and I realized all the suicidal fantasies were gone. They were just gone now, and I had suddenly been jolted into a reality where I realized how selfish and silly all these fantasies were, and that I could proceed now without them. And I have, although a friend... I told the story to a friend, and he reminded me. He said, "Don't worry, they come back."
Isn't that reassuring? That's what friends are for. But I imagine you've used some of those fantasies of your past for characters, or at least used them to help you understand marginal characters.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the secret of the creative life is how to feel at ease with your own embarrassment.
You know? That's interesting.
Yeah, because, you know, we're all in, you know, the dirty laundry business, and we're being paid, you know, to take risks and look silly, You know, some people, like race car drivers, get paid to risk their lives in a more concrete way. We get paid to risk our lives in an emotional way.
Since writing and directing a film is risky business in that respect, do you have to banish the film critic in you when you're working on a movie? You know, because a film critic is very critical, and that kind of criticism can paralyze you while you're in the creative process.
Yeah, absolutely. The analogy I like to draw is that the, you know, the film critic is like a medical examiner. He gets the cadaver on the table, he opens it up and tries to figure out how it lived or and why it died. And the filmmaker is like a pregnant mother who is just simply trying to nourish this thing and trying to make sure that it is not born, stillborn. So that you have to keep the medical examiner out of the delivery room because he will get in there and he will kill that baby.
That's a great analogy. I really like that. Well, Paul Schrader, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Paul Schrader spoke with Terry Gross last fall. His film Autofocus is available on DVD. It comes out on video July 8th.